Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, April 12, 2017. South Sudan's vice president warns leaders about the future of the country.
You know, if we allow the South to collapse in our hands, we, the leaders of today, without exception, even if you are under secretary or a director, you are already a leader. So please, it is a difficult time. And let us hold the bull by the horns.
And the former political detainees are calling on leaders from East Africa to rescue South Sudan.
Given what was going on, that we have a roundtable of all relevant parties and stakeholders to the agreement, and that roundtable, preferably this time, has even wider participation.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Civil society groups are condemning recent killings of unarmed civilians in Wau and Pajok by suspected government soldiers. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
Wau town residents say they are still hearing the sound of heavy gunfire today on the southwest side of the town, causing fear and panic among residents. ANMIS spokesperson in Juba, Daniel Dickinson, says, for the most part, the situation in Wau town is now calm and is slowly returning to normal. 2 days ago, witnesses said gunmen in military uniforms conducted house-to-house searches, shot and killed unarmed civilians, and burned down houses. At least 16 people were killed and 28 others wounded in the attack. Dickinson says ANMIS peacekeepers are now patrolling the town and protecting civilians.
Today, Wednesday and Tuesday, it's been calm. People are moving around town. We have received 200 to 300 people at the ANMIS protection of civilian site. They're being processed right now and being provided with services.
Thousands of villagers from Wau are seeking refuge at the United Nations-run camp and two local church compounds. Bonjore Peter Lado, who heads the local NGO Humanity South Sudan, says he was shocked to hear about the attack on innocent civilians. He says he can understand how deadly attack on civilians continue when UN agencies and the government have declared famine in parts of the country. Lado says the guns must be silent so that aid agencies can deliver urgently needed food aid to communities.
We were about to establish our state secretariat in Wau so that we are able to do our peace-building activities in Wau. And right now, if you start doing activities in Wau and there's insecurity, immediately there will be a lot of issues and questions raised against why you are interested to work there.
Lado says most aid agencies are afraid to provide services in violent or insecurity-prone areas of the country.
We are totally discouraged with the conflict, the fighting which is going on, and we want to ask all the people who are involved in this fighting to stop the fighting, stop attacking communities, stop attacking each other.
Florence Ida Inoka, who heads the World Women Development Association in Juba, says, like anywhere else, women in Wau borrow the brunt of Monday's violence.
I know how women suffer. When something goes bad, you go to the bush, no food, nowhere to sleep. A husband goes separately, children scatter separately. Women are raped, women are killed. Our husbands are dying. We are now homeless. Now what is the use that we are in South Sudan?
Inoka wonders how the proposed national dialogue will help restore peace when the government is not doing anything to resolve dispute among communities. She calls on the South Sudan's leaders to allow freedom of expression so ordinary people can speak without fear about situation in the country.
We have a lot in our hearts because we cannot express ourselves. We have no power. Those who have power are not looking to us. Now even eating, we cannot eat. Now in Juba here, most of the houses now are not taking tea because the sugar is very expensive. Even food. Now this woman in Wau is chased to go to the bush. How would you think that she will survive?
Stephen Robo Musa, the head of the Community Empowerment for Progress organization, or SEPO, in Wau, says This week's violence in Wau and Parajok a week ago contributes to what he calls a fragile relationship among the communities across the country. He says he does not think the national dialogue will restore peace unless perpetrators of crime like the Wau killings are apprehended and brought to book.
When they call for accountability, let accountability take place, because with that, we have already opened a space for a dialogue. Somebody, when those perpetrators have been held accountable and the victim are compensated for the loss, be their property or their families, at least they know who killed their family, and the one who killed them, they're held accountable. It is already encourages the dialogue process.
For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
South Sudan's vice president says officials in the Kiir administration should not allow the country to collapse in their hands. James Waniga spoke to lawmakers today about the format of the national dialogue, adding that the country should hold a national conference to gather views of all South Sudanese, including the armed opposition. For VOA News, Tito Justin has more from Juba.
Vice President Iga told dozens of South Sudanese government officials South Sudan tried to sign an agreement to resolve conflict in the country, but the peace deal is, in his words, standing on one leg. He says he is concerned that the situation is becoming more and more complex and the continued violence is tearing the country apart.
We cannot allow our country to be destroyed in this way, to be fragmented. We really have to do something, especially we, the leaders of today. You know, if we allow the South to collapse in our hands, we, the leaders of today, without exception, even if you are under secretary or a director, you are already a leader in that particular institution, and it means a leader in the government. So please, it is a difficult time, and let us hold the bull by the horns.
Last month, Information Minister Michael Makwe announced preconditions for armed groups participating in the national dialogue, saying they and people living in rebel-controlled areas must first renounce rebellion.
For the opposition, as long as they continue to be called armed opposition and they have not denounced violence, then they don't deserve to even talk about this dialogue, because originally they don't accept whatever is done by the government. These are the people who are demanding that this government must go.
Striking a more conciliatory tone, Iga says the process must be inclusive if it is going to achieve the intended objectives. In addition, he says transparency and public participation by people from all walks of life will enable leaders to understand people's grievances. Iga is also suggesting that the Kiir administration give general amnesty to all groups and individuals that took up arms against the government, and release individuals being detained in connection with the ongoing conflict.
An effective national dialogue convened on broad basis of stakeholders for a meaningful deliberative process. In this sense, all main interest groups, ranging from women, youth, major groups, transitional groups, political parties, including those in the opposition and so on, should be invited to partake. If we omit them, then we are likely to fail in this, and we are unlikely to resolve the conflict.
Iga urged the lawmakers in the General Assembly and the Kiir administration to take the national dialogue very seriously and to visit their constituencies and spread the message of peace.
National dialogue is an instrument which can lead to conflict resolution, political transformation, peaceful coexistence, and we need peaceful coexistence regardless of the 64 tribes. And opening up the political space for participation of the civil society. We need our civil society to participate effectively.
South Sudan Humanitarian Affairs Minister Hussein Mar Nyot says the media should play a big role in educating the public about the national dialogue so citizens can participate from an informed point of view. Nyot acknowledges that the media is not reporting freely about the national dialogue because people are afraid to openly express their views for fear of a crackdown by national security service operatives.
There is nothing much that happened here with the media, whether it is on the TV, the radio, the newspapers and all this, because there is intense fear that whoever writes an article, you publish some pictures of some individuals, you will be subjected to arrest.
Nyot recommends that civil society activists and the media be allowed the freedom to create awareness about the national dialogue and freedom of speech. Robert Ladu, chairperson of the South Sudanese Commission, says some South Sudanese security personnel behave in a manner that makes them a threat to ordinary people.
If I have to extort money from somebody and have a security man, I use the security to threaten him. Even to attract him, and if somebody is competing with me over a woman, I use the security to threaten him. So this is a very dangerous thing, the security apparatus. A good job is being done, but we should also be very careful because we are sending people to those who are fighting against us outside.
Late last year, President Salva Kiir announced the dialogue would begin in early March, but due to financial constraints, officials say the event has yet to be scheduled. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
A group of former political detainees, also known as the G10, are calling on regional and international leaders to intervene and end the conflict in South Sudan. The leaders met with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni in Uganda last week to share their concerns. Government spokesman Michael Makuei says the group should return to Juba and take part in the national dialogue. For VOA News, Simon Udu has more from Juba.
The group was led to Uganda by Rebecca Nyandeng, widow of SPLM founder John Garangi Mabior, who is often called the mother of South Sudan. Kosti Manibe, one of the former detainees, says in their talks with President Museveni, the group focused on how to revamp some parts of the peace agreement he says have collapsed. Manibe says the former detainees believe conditions in South Sudan will continue to deteriorate unless the warring parties return to the bargaining table to renegotiate and resuscitate the peace deal.
Given what was going on, that we have a roundtable of all relevant parties and stakeholders to the agreement, and that such roundtable, preferably this time, has even wider participation than those that are participating in negotiating the agreement.
Manibe says a renegotiated peace agreement should focus on certain items such as security arrangements, which he says should be overhauled. South Sudan Information Minister Michael Makuei says there will be no renegotiated settlement. The August 2015 agreement is final.
We are continuing with the national dialogue as the way of resolving South Sudan problems. So this idea of they saying that we want to renegotiate and so forth is out of question.
Prior to meeting President Museveni, the G10 met with the Tanzanian President John Magufuli, Rwandan President Paul Kagame, and officials in U.S. President Donald Trump's administration recently. Manibe says Museveni expressed his concerns and frustrations over the increasing volatile situation in South Sudan, which has affected trade relations between Juba and Kampala and has forced hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese to seek refuge in Uganda. Makuei denies the government is responsible for the mass exodus out of South Sudan.
The majority of the people who are going to the neighboring countries as refugees are economic refugees or people who are actually affected by the drought, by the famine, and these are people who are looking for something to eat in the neighboring countries.
Manibe says the G10 wants regional leaders like President Museveni to intervene and help save the peace deal in order to prevent further bloodshed in South Sudan. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at what it takes to start a business in South Sudan. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you do to wake up in the morning when you are tired?
What I do in the morning, if I'm so tired on the bed, sometimes I go for exercise. I jog in the morning.
I feel there are things that I needed to do in the morning. I really have to force myself to wake up because I need to accomplish that task. But if, like, I do not have very demanding program that I needed to do in the morning, I somehow relax.
My phone alarm, then I have to put it like thrice. The first one goes on, I'm like struggling, and then the next one I wake up.
It's a little bit of a tricky question, but for my case, I'm busy. I do a lot of work, so automatically I just set up, like I wake up early in the morning every day, so it becomes like part of my life.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Lack of regulations in the private business sector, sporadic violence, and poor sanitation are some of the problems business owners in Juba struggle with on a daily basis. A new report from One Earth Future, a nonprofit that works on sustainable peace in conflict-ridden countries, looks at the fragility in South Sudan's economy and the coping mechanism businesses have developed during harsh times. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
Victor Oduno Awor, a research associate at One Earth Future, or OEF, focused on Somaliland, the Eastern Democratic of Congo, and South Sudan. But he says, out of all three places, the deteriorating conditions in South Sudan were far worse than those in the other two areas of Africa. In South Sudan, business owners have to deal with issues like the high cost of energy and language barriers, but even with the more chronic issues.
Like the exchange rate issue, I met a lot of small business owners in South Sudan who stopped their businesses because they couldn't afford to pay rent or electricity had been cut. And many of them in the South Sudan scenario, unlike Somaliland where there's human capital development, you're finding a lot of the South Sudanese are not as gainfully employed.
The poor economic conditions in South Sudan have reduced disposable incomes, forcing people to eat out less often, which ultimately hurts restaurant businesses across the country. Awor says strengthening the private sector could mitigate fragility within South Sudan's economy and could eventually boost revenues for businesses. Awor points out that it is important to note that intergovernmental organizations and expats could also hurt local businesses.
Many of these international organizations are willing to pay whatever the rent is. They don't bargain. Some of those rents compared to Nairobi, compared to DC, was reasonable. But in those standards, $1,000 is a lot of money in Juba. But $1,000 in Nairobi, yeah, it's still some money, but maybe not as much. Out $1,000 here, you would be hard-pressed to find an apartment for $1,000.
The report documented almost 11% of businesses in South Sudan suspended their operations due to difficulties associated with operating in the country. But instead of closing their businesses, Awor says business owners and investors should instead focus on training employees, while civil society should focus on empowering citizens.
Rwandan people don't have a chance to participate in governing their own selves. The other thing is skills. Because when people have the skills, the schools are running right, then, you know, you can question. A school is typically a place where you learn and you also question as you're learning. The schools, when they don't operate, obviously fragility will come.
During his research in South Sudan in 2015, Awor says he found that most of the businesses were managed or owned by foreigners, mainly Kenyans, Ethiopians, and Eritreans. Awor says it could be more beneficial to employ locals, since South Sudanese typically intend to live in the country longer than foreign workers. He says investors should begin to look into finding capable work for ordinary South Sudanese citizens. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
Yei River State is known for its agricultural potential, but farmers there worry that continued insecurity in their villages will prevent them from accessing their farmland as the next planting season approaches. Daniel Friday Martin has the story for VOA from Yei.
In 2015, President Salva Kiir donated 20 tractors with the hope of boosting food production in the area. But last year, most farmers say they were unable to harvest their crops because of the ongoing violence in the area, which forced hundreds of thousands of residents to flee to neighboring Uganda. Now farmers say even with the new tractors, they cannot plant crops because of the continued fighting between government and opposition forces. The farmers say unless peace is restored, they will not be able to produce food this year, which will only worsen already widespread food shortages in South Sudan. Farmer John Mawa says rampant insecurity in Ye River has prevented him from planting crops on several of his acres of farmland.
The biggest challenges we are facing is insecurity. My plan for this year was I had wanted to have enough cassava, and I also planned to have a finger millet. My appeal to the government is, since the process of dialogue is going on, we are hoping that let this peace, a dialogue, bring us total peace so that we can feel free to use the land.
Ma says he will only return to his farm when the government restores peace. Esther Kiden says much as she would love to farm, it is particularly dangerous for women to go to their villages and till the land.
If you are lucky, they rape you and they leave your life. But if you are not lucky, they kill you. So we are fearing. We cannot do anything.
Kiden is calling on non-governmental organizations to provide food aid to the population, which she calls vulnerable. Victor Dada, a commercial farmer, is appealing to the government to ensure the proposed dialogue leads to lasting peace and stability in the rural areas so that villages can return to their farms without fear.
You cannot move. So it is really very difficult. We cannot plant, we cannot grow anything. But now, people are talking about relief, not seeds anymore. I don't have the time. I don't have the place to put these seeds in. What we need in the country is dialogue. We need serious peace.
Edmond Gogo, Ye River State Director General for Agriculture, admits farmers won't be able to produce any food this farming season because of the insecurity. He too is calling on aid agencies to supply up to 5 months of food rations to residents and to continue delivering short-term hand tools and seeds so that when the fighting finally stops, farmers can return to tilling the land.
As I speak to you now, very few people only planted vegetable seeds when the warring parties have declared permanent ceasefire. That is the condition that most of the farmers would like to see.
The United Methodist Church on Relief, or UMCO, is one of the 8 groups supporting agricultural activities in Ye County. UMCO Program Manager Dara Elisa warns that thousands of people are stranded in Ye County due to the conflict and may suffer from famine unless aid agencies distribute food aid.
The situation in Ye can't be intervened in one way. It needs a multiple kind of approach. Direct food distribution is one of it. Giving the farmers tools and seeds is another one. But we felt that it's important for people to have their own food from their farms.
Elisa says if nothing happens, food security will deteriorate even further in Ye River State and people are going to die. For VOA News, I'm Daniel Friday Martin.
From Ye, we move to South Africa, where opposition parties are protesting outside President Jacob Zuma's official home in Pretoria to demand his resignation in the wake of long simmering corruption scandals, a controversial cabinet reshuffle, and economic distresses. Zuma has fired back at his critics, accusing them of racism. The president faces a vote of no confidence in parliament next week. Anita Powell reports for VOA from Pretoria.
A celebratory atmosphere hung over President Zuma's home on this, his 75th birthday. Tens of thousands of South Africans donned bright colors and marched Wednesday to his official residence in central Pretoria, singing and dancing as they made their way through the streets. They were not bringing birthday wishes. They were asking the increasingly unpopular leader to leave. 7 major opposition parties organized the march at Pretoria's union buildings and said they will continue to loudly and peacefully protest Zuma for the duration of his term, which is set to end in 2019. The president has earned many critics for long simmering corruption scandals, but his decision last month to fire a well-respected finance minister and reorganize his cabinet prompted those critics to call for a nationwide shutdown and protests on Friday. The opposition has called for a no-confidence vote in Parliament next week. Protester Tsebele Bapela, 35, a supporter of the far-left Economic Freedom Fighters Party, said the long-ruling African National Congress, the party Zuma leads, is his true target.
I don't only want Zuma to resign, but what I'm calling for the ANC to leave. ANC is not in the interest of the people of South Africa. ANC is not in the interest of the poorest of the people of South Africa.
Like Bapela, many people in the mostly black crowd refuted Zuma's claims that those who stand against him are racists. A florist who gave only her first name, Bongiwe, said she does not identify with any particular political party and accused the president of race baiting.
He sows division by always playing the race card to suit his own plans and ambitions. So we don't buy it. As black people, we also have... we believe in ethics. We know what's right and what's wrong. We believe in accountable government. We are anti-corruption. You know, it's not a white thing. It's not a black thing. It's a human thing. It has nothing to do with color. So really, Zuma, your time is up.
As tens of thousands of participants sang, danced, blew vuvuzelas, and created a party-like atmosphere on the lawns of the president's home, one of the youngest protesters, six-week-old Jan, slept through the whole thing. His mother, 38-year-old Susanna Hutton, said she felt strongly that she needed to interrupt her maternity leave to peacefully protest Zuma.
He's the main leader and he doesn't lead by example. And it seems like everything that filters down is led by him in terms of the breakdown of the country.
Zuma did not make an appearance before the crowd, choosing instead to meet in Soweto with supporters, many of whom had been bussed in from other provinces where he remains popular. In a statement, Zuma's office said his birthday wish is to see more progress being made in building a better life for the poor and the working class. Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria.
That report by Anita Powell brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song One Nation, One People by Isaka Number One.
Isaka Number One. Big talent. Togetherness is all we need. Togetherness is all we need. Peace and harmony. Shaking my feet.
We have been listening to Isaka Number One with the song One People, One Nation. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Yeah.